Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Long Story Short, the podcast about storytelling and connection, where we interview marketers and entrepreneurs to hear the story they tell about their brands. I'm Jeff.
And I'm Sophia. This is a podcast by humans for humans who also happen to be marketers. On this week's show, our guest is AJ Dopwell.
AJ has a passion for providing access to better healthcare and for pushing the pharmaceutical industry to find supportive solutions for patients, caregivers, and healthcare professionals. He has more than 15 years of experience in healthcare sciences and marketing, spanning major pharma, consulting, and agency positions. Currently, he's a senior manager of omnichannel marketing at Novo Nordisk. He wears multiple hats, including DTC and HCP paid promotional strategies, audience targeting development, tactical execution, and campaign optimization for the GLP-1 franchise. Prior to joining NNI, AJ spent time on the agency side as vice president of media at CMI and account director at Cadient. In addition, AJ guest lectures at his alma mater, Temple University, speaking with students preparing to launch their professional careers in marketing, media, and communications. AJ lives in Philadelphia with his partner, Mark, and together they enjoy traveling, dining out, and spending time exploring the city.
In this episode, we will discuss everything from how to bring the creative marketing spirit into something as regulated as pharma, to the shift between working on the agency versus client side of marketing, to how AJ and his team tackle the industry buzzword and frequent bottleneck attribution. Gain insight on the ins and outs of the pharma industry through the lens of someone who has been interested in it since age 7.
Yeah, and AJ's story of how he became interested in healthcare and pharma is so powerful. So without further ado, please enjoy our conversation with AJ Dopwell.
AJ, welcome to Long Story Short. Thank you so much for being here.
Absolutely, Sophia. Thank you for having me.
Of course. So to get right into it, we've established you have a broad array of experience in both marketing and advertising, but across all of that, you've established yourself in the pharma industry specifically. So we want to start by asking you, why pharma?
Yeah, so great question. I actually have had an interesting path into my career. And it all started when I was very young. I was about 7 years old, and I actually suffered. I had a medical condition where essentially required some surgery, some inpatient. I was actually hospitalized for quite a bit. All good now. But while I was there as a child, it was a children's hospital. And so there was a lot of fun activities, and I didn't feel like I was sick. So, after surgery and I was recuperating, I really spent a fair amount of time just kind of going on rounds, if you will, with the nursing staff and even the physicians. I still remember my physician to this day, and that was like, 32 years ago. But at the end of the day, I really enjoyed the experience there, even though the circumstances were not so great. And that just kind of stuck with me. So after that, obviously went through the rest of grade school, middle school, high school, and around 15, when you can get that first real job, I never lost sight of that. And I ended up, my first job was actually in a pharmacy.
Wow.
And I worked in the pharmacy. So I wasn't in the front of the store. I was actually in the pharmacy section. And it was interesting. And it just kind of reinforced that interest that I had had from a young age. And I went to college and I was originally a pharmacy major. And it wasn't until I became an intern in the pharmacy where I started to realize, I don't know if I want to make this the rest of my life. When I really took stock of what the role was, and ultimately, did I see myself doing this for 30 plus years? And I came to the realization that maybe it wasn't the right fit for me. But I still very much had an affinity to, the sciences, the overall, compounding elements of the role of the job. And so I was able to kind of pull that forward into my marketing career, which kind of morphed after I left the more health sciences focused trajectory I was on. And I changed my major and I graduated from college from the School of Communications, Marketing Marcom. And my first role was actually at an ad agency where I was able to blend the pharma side of things with the undergrad degree I received, and ultimately working for pharmaceutical clients. So it just kind of came together. It certainly wasn't a plan. And in fact, the first role that I had was specifically within media planning, which is, you know, a component of advertising that in college, I said to myself and even my classmates, I'm never going to work in media planning ever. And it wasn't until I actually took the role and started working, and I remembered that many times I had that conversation in college, and I was like, you know what? Wow. Look how this shaped up. So at the end of the day, it all worked out, but I spent, you know, I would say about 12 years on the agency side, working my way up, different clients, always stayed in pharma. And what I really then wanted to do, I started to gain more insight into, you know, what my clients' roles were. And it was intriguing to me because it went well beyond media. And that was something that I really wanted to tap into. So in my current role, which was the role I ended up leaving the agency world for, as a senior manager for omnichannel marketing at Novo Nordisk. So that's where I am today. And there's still absolutely a media component to the role, but I see much more of the full picture, if you will, as it relates to, you know, the entire pharma ecosystem from, you know, product inception to FDA approval to coming to market launches, and then as a brand matures through its life cycle. So there's a lot that goes into that, well beyond the advertising component, the promotion side of it. And that's what's been most intriguing. And it's been a great move. So far, things are going really well. And it's going on 3 years.
That's congratulations.
Great. Thank you. Yeah, it was a good move for me. And it came at the right time, I think, professionally as well.
So let me ask you something specific. There's a statement you have about crafting innovative marketing solutions in complex and highly regulated industries. And I think people may have a sense that in a regulatory environment, specifically like pharma, it actually makes innovation impossible. And this is somewhat of an oxymoron. So just kind of curious, can you talk about how you keep sort of the creative marketing spirit and bring that into something as sort of seemingly, you know, regulatory and walled off the way pharma is?
Sure. So you're absolutely right. I forget the source, but it was a few years ago, I actually read an article that essentially stated that pharma healthcare marketing was the second most regulated industry after finance.
Right.
And so by regulations, that means a lot. But at the end of the day, what it really comes down to is we really have to ensure any promotion, any marketing, any sort of communication that's in outreach adheres to the label, the FDA approval that our products receive. So you may have heard of off-label promotion. None of that is acceptable. So we have to be very clear on what our strategies are, how we implement them, and ultimately how we communicate to healthcare providers and to patients. So how to keep the creativity going in our world is, it really depends on the individual. You know, if you're in this field and you've been in this field, specifically the pharma vertical, for, you know, a certain number of years, you understand what we're working with, and you truly are in it for the right reasons. There are times when, you know, I'll talk to people, you know, just starting out looking for their first role, and they're like, oh, what do you do? And I explain it. And they're like, oh, that sounds cool. I really would love to get into that field and, you know, do things creative. I love advertising. I'm like, advertising, you love advertising, but I need you to help me understand what you like about it. Because in our industry, you're not necessarily going to get the exposure or the opportunity to do the super flashy, you know, quick turnaround. You receive, you know, a new brand launch and you're in market the very next day with it. You're not really going to get that sense of exposure in pharma. We have longer lead times. And so when we really think about, you know, what's our next big idea, it's all grounded in solid strategies, again, that adhere to what are we approved to say and what do our patients need? Because the other thing that we want to be conscious of when we're thinking about creativity and innovation is not just doing something new and different and flashy, but making sure that it provides value and it has a place. Because at the end of the day, with the lead times, tremendous amount of resources go into that. So if ultimately we invest the time, the resources into an idea, and let's say it falls flat, it's probably because we started off at the wrong place. Mm-hmm. And so we really do take our time and think through all of the necessary steps to be creative, to drive innovation, all under the lens of, it's got to be about our patients and it's got to be about our HCPs, because at the end of the day, they're our customers, if you will. So we just make sure that we don't lose sight of them when we start thinking of our big grand strategies for the upcoming year.
That's great. And I think that's so powerful to hear that even in an industry that some, you know, outsiders may see as sort of, you can't have that sort of creative energy in because of the regulations. But I think at the end of the day, and I really love the way you put it, that it's still ultimately about working backwards from your audience, right? And what do you, mm-hmm. what does your audience need to hear? There's just restrictions on what you can and can't say. And frankly, a lot of these obviously for good reason. So, and you mentioned sort of those two different audiences, the HCP, the healthcare professionals, and then the direct consumers at the end of the day. Can you just talk a little bit about some of the difference and the nuance around sort of what their needs may be from a messaging perspective and sort of maybe how you go about approaching those two audiences differently?
Sure. Yeah. And believe it or not, the approach to identifying the end user needs and wants and desires is fairly consistent regardless of audience. So it really is grounded in research and data. You know, again, because so much of our resources go into any single idea, we make sure that before we pull the trigger on anything, it really is a sound decision that has some sort of projected outcome. And for us, when we think about, you know, what do our patients need? What are we looking, what are they looking for? You know, we have an entire, and this isn't unique to my organization, but within pharma, we have robust research engines as it relates to understanding, you know, where the patient is, how do we meet them where they are, how do we continue to support them through their health journey? Because that's what it's really about. All patients who are patients are on some sort of journey, whether it be regardless of disease state or condition. Mm-hmm. So when we think about, you know, what exactly are our communications going to be, we have to understand, you know, where our patients are. And I'll be honest with you, we can't meet every single patient where they are in their journey. But what we can do is make informed decisions for the masses and try to be as tailored and addressable, if you will, to those patients. And so they feel as though, and we know who they are because they've communicated to us and we want to provide support to them. And it's similar for our healthcare providers, because without our HCPs, our patients cannot gain access to therapies that are perhaps even saving their lives. So we have to make sure that our HCPs understand, lead with the science. This is what the data tells us. This is what, you know, our clinical trial results were. We communicate what our primary, secondary endpoints, all of those different nuances that go into making a treatment decision. We want to make sure that the healthcare provider has quick and easy access to that. We don't need them or want them necessarily having to feel like they have to lift the burden to do their own research. That's been done. So how do we communicate that out in a concise manner? Because at the end of the day, HCPs, especially this past year, extremely busy. They've pulled in multiple directions. They've got patient care. Now they've got to worry about how do they manage their patient load virtually? How do they keep their offices safe? So there's a lot on their plate. And the last thing we really want to do is add to that by saying, you know, here's a product, here's a URL, and here are a few other websites that you can learn more about it. You know, we want to be very direct. We want to be specific. And frankly, we want to hear from them through our sales reps, again, through research. What is it that they need from us? And then can we meet them where they are?
That's great. And I think you talk about a whole lot of different touch points. And I think, you know, from the context of our perspective of working with a lot of B2B software marketers, we talk about from a data perspective, attribution is a hot topic and a really difficult difficult task for a lot of marketers when there's a long and complex sales cycle, right? And in the pharma space, it's not just complex, it's also indirect. And so to your point, there's a lot of touch points, but advertising directly to a patient potentially and being able to sort of speak to them where they are is still different. You know, there's still a whole lot of steps that have to happen before that's going to lead to any kind of uptick for your brand. So can you just talk kind of, you know, high level about some of how that data comes together and how you identify which promotions and which messages are most effective?
Absolutely. You use an excellent word, one that I don't think there's a day that goes by where it's not uttered internally, which is attribution. And also, like you said, within the pharma industry, there are a lot of levers. There are a lot of touch points that ultimately drive conversion. So in the sense of new to brand, new prescriptions, mm-hmm. patient volume, and how we quantify that, there is a very sophisticated model that is in place that I will give you an overview of.
Sure.
But essentially, if you think about all of your different promotional channels, and that's non-personal, that's personal. So thinking about a face-to-face rep detail, thinking about the TV commercial, thinking about a banner ad on a website, your search engine marketing, all of these different things are in play, all these different tactics. So what we are, with history, years of history and research that we have in data, what we're able to understand is, for a given channel, what is the projected attribution or contribution to an ultimate conversion? And then what we're able to do is take those various touch points, those search impressions, those TBTRPs, the number of rep details, the number of samples distributed, the number of banner impressions served, all of those different inputs. And we essentially synthesize them into this engine that I referenced. And it helps us understand from an ROI and a conversion standpoint, where are we driving? Where are we seeing success? And maybe where are we maybe falling short? Mm-hmm. And how do we optimize? So that's a constant process. It's not a, you know, here's 12 months campaign. We're going to launch it on Jan 1. It's going to run for 12 months. And we see how we do in Q1 of the following year. No, we look at that daily. We review it in terms of actual readouts monthly, and we make changes, sometimes even weekly, to our efforts. Because again, if we're starting to see certain areas lag, there are ways we can improve, whether a stronger call to action, whether it's, you know, maybe we need to refine our search keywords. Maybe we're finding that our patients are searching for more therapeutic type keywords as opposed to branded keywords. So there are a lot of learnings that we gain from the data we have access to. And then that ultimately feeds into the conversion model, which helps us understand, did what we put in market do well? And if not, what do we need? What did we learn and how can we change it?
Yeah, that's great. And it's funny because you sort of started this by talking about how pharma by definition is not the flashy sort of quick turnaround, but the fact that you're able to be sounding so nimble within your own operations and the way you're able to sort of change your execution and optimize on essentially a daily basis. I mean, it's funny. So sure, you can sort of think of it that way, but I mean, everything you're sort of talking about sounds to me like it really does still have a lot of the sort of the flash, even if it's not necessarily the, you know, sort of the brands people grow accustomed to when, you know, mm-hmm. sort of they grow up and, you know, have an affinity to particular, you know, consumer brands especially.
No, absolutely. And again, the fundamentals are there. They are consistent regardless of industry in terms of, you know, marketing, how you optimize, refine, and hopefully prove success. Really for us, the main difference is when we are thinking about those strategies, we go into it thinking, you know, I'll use an example, a television commercial. Mm-hmm. We've got a 90-second spot. They're expensive to produce. But at the same time, we also go into it knowing we need to have multiple concepts at our disposal. So instead of going in with one 90-second spot and running it, we may go into our MLR team, our medical legal review team, compliance team, and say, we've got three different concepts. We've tested them all. They've all done well. Let's get all three approved. And we may launch with one, but we've got two in the hopper once we start to see that response data. That, you know, maybe this one isn't gaining traction. There's no attribution here. Patients aren't making the connection. Okay, let's go with V2 and let's see how that does. And maybe it's, you know, you start pulling different levers. Maybe it's a mix of both. Maybe you run the first version on certain networks. And there are different things that we kind of have ready to go. So it may appear we're more nimble and making a pivot on the fly, but it's all been planned for. And that's really the difference there. We just can't see something and create something on a whim. It's got to already be ready to go in case we need to use it.
That's great. Yeah, that's so fascinating. And I really love that idea as somebody who, you know, what I always try to say is I don't necessarily have all the answers, but I know how to test into them. And so, you know, frankly, it sounds like you need to be a little more organized potentially because you don't have the freedom to on the fly just say, hey, let's just change the subject line. Let's just change the messaging here. But so you need to be more thoughtful in advance. But being able to come to the table again, as long as all of them are pre-approved, that still gives you that same flexibility.
It sure does. Yep. So
let me ask you, because again, you were saying that, you know, you had spent the large majority of your career until the last couple of years on the agency side, and now you've been on the client side. And I know there's, I don't want to call it a rivalry, but I think there's a healthy sort of like, I don't want to total misunderstanding of what those roles are, but I think people on the agency side have an idea of what their clients are doing day to day and vice versa. So just wondering, since you've now had sort of significant experience on both sides, if you can kind of sort of share what you see those as being the differences.
Yeah, and they're significant. And coming from the agency world, you know, you're absolutely right. There are perceptions about what your clients do on a day-to-day basis, because especially if you work in a certain vertical within the agency, so if you're only media or if you're only copy, you think, well, my client, all they're doing is reading my subject lines and telling me they're good to go, or they're only reading the flow chart for the media plan and saying approved. I have a new appreciation, one that I never had until I moved into the client world, for the work that goes into the marketing side of this. And the differences really are the biggest one. Your clients do more than they work on with you. And that was the biggest eye opener, because while I still oversee paid media, I also, and that's just, you know, the strategy, the execution, the buying, I also have a hand in creative. I also have a hand in market access and what we're doing in pharmacy. And all of those different channels have different agency stakeholders as well as internal stakeholders. So that status call I was on with my media agency at 9:30 was one of 19 calls that day. And that was the only one on media. And so I think that's the biggest thing. We do a lot more than when you're not on this side, you believe actually takes place. And it's what I was hoping to gain by making this move, which was greater exposure. I just didn't know it would be this great. But at the same time, it's almost a double-edged sword, because it is that great, because I get to see so much upstream than before, when I was kind of on the tail end, like anchor leg. I'm starting the relay. And that's what's really great about this side of things, because I'm not really just handed information. I'm at the table when decisions are being made that impact media and creative and copy and strategy. So that's the biggest, I would say, misperception when you're just on the agency side and you don't have that visibility. A lot more goes into what your client does than you see.
So on the topic of seeing so much from this transition, another thing that is unique about your position is that the company you work for, Novo Nordisk, isn't even based in the United States. So not only are you seeing so much more within the realm of your work, but you're also working for a company that has a different scale, and you might be working with different audiences. So we're really interested in how that shapes the story that you tell working within the company, how it shapes the company story, how you interact with your patients on that level. Is there anything different you've noticed there as well?
So I will say one thing that this role has allowed me to gain greater visibility into is what happens on the global stage. So most pharma companies are structured in a way, there's a US-based team, and then there's a global team. And global is basically ex-US, everything outside of the United States. Right. And within global, there are micro teams, if you will. So there could be a global team in Asia, and there could be multiple teams within a certain country within Asia. Same could go for, you know, Africa, South America, et cetera. So in this role, what I'm able to gain access to now is, from a campaign perspective, a lot of the, again, upstream insights that come from global, because most campaigns, not just my organization, but this is industry-wide for the most part, most campaigns, most brand launches, they start globally. And then you have your pull through into the various geographical regions that, you know, you have your units assigned to, like US. So what I'm able to do is participate in conversations, because this year with COVID-19, not much travel happened. So everything was virtual. But even before then, we were mostly virtual, but talking to our global colleagues, understanding, you know, what their challenges were, ex-US, how they were addressing them, what might we need to be prepared for, because let's say a compound or a molecule is first approved globally. So let's say a product is approved in the EU, it may not yet be approved here in the US by the FDA. So if that's the case, there's that cross-pollination, if you will, of ideas and sharing of, you know, what are you experiencing? What are you seeing? And vice versa. If a product launches first here in the US, we then share with our global colleagues, this is what we're seeing. These are the challenges we came up against. And, you know, how might you modify your strategies to account for them before you're course correcting? You can just kind of get out of the gates correctly the first time. Mm-hmm. So that's been interesting because, again, being more upstream, you have access to that. As opposed to just being delivered information. So that's been interesting, moving over from the agency side to have direct involvement in a lot of the dialogue that ultimately feeds down into everything we do, even beyond marketing. You know, how to price a product, working with our market access team, working with managed care formulary decision makers, where does the product fall in the formulary? Are we tier one? Are we tier two? Working with the sales team, you know, where does this product fall within the bag? Is it detailed first? Is it third? So there are a lot of different components that help us understand with Marcom, what do we need to do to account for what happens outside of our team, but also more importantly, what happens globally for the product? Because at the end of the day, we're all working for the same team. It's just we're structured differently based on geography.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Jeff and I have actually done some research recently about how one of the biggest things, especially going into 2021, is the need to connect and still collaborate with our teams, which of course with COVID has only been made harder. So it sounds like that's such an integral role. And from what you've said, it seems like you're doing a pretty great job of connecting, not just with your teams here, but on that global scale, which is really essential.
Yeah, I will say that was one of the surprising elements of the reality we're all living with COVID-19 is how productive we all remained without in-person meetings and FaceTime. And I think it's been a positive revelation, frankly, because we were all accustomed to doing things one way. That's how we operate. This is the business. This is what we've done for years. And what we have learned, many of us, hopefully most of us have learned, is we don't have to sit in a conference room to make decisions and have a discussion. And it might be over Teams or Zoom or whatever it may be, but work can still be done. And for me, that's been great to see, because I've always been a little bit, I've been the one or one of few who have really wanted to challenge, do we all need to be in this room for this? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Could this have been an email? Things like that. So I think this year has been really great in that regard. And there's not much to be grateful for this year, frankly. So if there is a silver lining, I'll take that.
Yeah. As somebody who's worked remotely for 11 years, I can say the same exact thing. Right. And I did just, this is naturally sort of my way of things, is when COVID first hit, I found myself sort of initially just making a list of potential silver linings, right? Like what are some things that might be good out of this? And that was actually one of the first things that came to my mind, is hoping that some companies and institutions that have been loath to allow sort of the flexibility of people working remotely, hopefully finding out firsthand that, guess what, their companies were just fine. And so, you know, not necessarily that they'll move to a full, okay, everybody remote all the time, but at least that they'll have flexibility and have that option, right? So,
yep, totally agree. So yeah, that's a win.
Yeah.
So speaking of wins and positivity, we'll keep that trend going. Why not, right? We all could use some of it. So one thing, obviously, as we've established, is that you've been in this industry, even if you've bounced around a little bit, for quite some time. And I know you started even at 15 with your interest, and even 7 if you want to go farther back where your passions began and how it led you to where you are now. But I guess what we want to know is, for people who are trying to break into either advertising and marketing, or more broadly speaking, advertising and marketing, or more specifically, the pharma industry of doing that, do you have any advice for them? What should they look out for, things that they should be doing? What would you have wanted to know as you were coming into all of this?
Yeah, so a couple things with that. I would say, and this doesn't necessarily apply to marketing or even pharma, but anyone looking to start a career, I think just a general good place to begin is, if you're thinking one direction, why are you thinking that? What about it draws you to it? And it needs to be more than just, well, it was my major. Because yeah. at that point, you could find yourself stuck, if you will, because you're just trying to make use of that degree and stick with a plan that may not make sense for you anymore. So really think about it, because while it's not the absolute be-all, your first job, it's good to start off in the right place so that you don't find yourself backtracking or pivoting in a way that may hurt you and your growth. That said, I would say if someone is, you know what, I'm interested in marketing, I'm interested in pharma, again, I'd ask the same question. What about it draws you in? Mm-hmm. Because one recommendation or one consideration I would say everyone should have is understand the environment that you're getting into. Again, we talked earlier about the regulations. And frankly, if you're coming into marketing or advertising to be super flashy and, you know, to run 15-second TV spots and have, you know, actors and actresses in your creative, this may not be the outlet for you. It's possible, but let's taper that expectation. But I would say if you're really focused on it and you love the science, you believe in healthcare, you believe in what it can do for a community, for a population, then I would say, you know what, don't lose that. That's one of the biggest things, if not the biggest, just don't lose that passion, that desire, because when you really break it down, you will be challenged frequently when you start to, you know, pull together your ideas, your communication strategies, your outreach approaches and things along that nature. You really have to be diligent and focused and determined, mm-hmm. because again, it's very easy to want to give up when, let's say, your idea starts to be challenged and it might start to erode a bit, mm-hmm. and it's not exactly what you wanted it to be, but it still will be impactful. You just have to be able to pivot, absorb that, and use it, and then keep moving forward. Because at the end of the day, you're still doing this because you have the passion for patients, mm-hmm. and for caregivers. And if you don't lose sight of that, you'll be golden.
Yep, that's great. Going to say along the same lines of just sticking to the passion, not that I have the industry experience, but from what you were saying, it sounds like if that passion's there, then this is the place for you to be. And
absolutely,
if there's passion that's lying in other industries, then those are the industries you should be going towards, not
this. And even within pharma, again, there are many different avenues within the industry. So we're focusing a lot on marketing and advertising in this conversation, but I've mentioned some other things too. You know, there's market access, there's trade, there's governance, there's regulatory, there's Salesforce. Do you want to be a sales rep? I mean, there are a lot of different avenues. So even if you have that passion, you may find that, you know, marketing may not be, pharma marketing may not be for me, but maybe I should try, you know, clinical trial marketing or sales rep support and go work out in the field. There's a lot of different avenues to explore. So if you hit that initial wall, don't think that it's the wrong move as an industry. Try something else within the industry.
That's great. And then along those same lines of what you wish you knew, I guess, what's one thing that helps define success for you? And I know you have done a lot, but you still have a lot of career left to go. And this can be success in a personal sense. It can be in a professional sense. But I think that's success is a word we use a lot, but can be very specific and unique to our own journey and how we define it. So I'm intrigued to hear what that means for you.
Yeah, so one of the aspects of my role is we have a patient call center, a patient support center, where our patients will call in and they may have questions about their therapy, they may have questions about their condition. It runs the gamut, right? We, with patient consent, we record those conversations and we anonymize them and we share them internally. So that we can understand what some of the challenges are. We talk about data and research. That's a huge stream for us. We learn a lot from what our patients are willing to tell us through the call center. And for me, what really is an extremely positive component of this role is being able to hear some of those recordings. We don't hear them all the time, I will say, but when they do come through, most people really drop what they're doing and listen into them. And they're not long, but at the end of the day, it's just so powerful to hear some of these patients. For many of them, they consider our products their lifeline. Mm-hmm. For many of them, our products may have saved their lives. And they are very forthcoming with that information. They get emotional. They're very thankful. They're extremely appreciative, and they communicate all of that back to us. So for me, hearing those calls is certainly an area of, I just feel proud that I had some input and some involvement in bringing a therapy to whatever the patient is on, whoever they are, and they have been able to maybe find their life again, because a lot of our patients really have lost sight of that. And they communicate that back to us. Mm-hmm. I was diagnosed with this condition. I felt my life was over until my doctor prescribed whatever it may be. So that's an area where it's more of a daily reinforcement when I get those recordings to listen to. Mm-hmm. And then ultimately on a larger scale is being able to deliver. This is more of my own personal, it's professional and personal, but more on me. Being able to deliver what I know I can deliver to the role that I have. Mm-hmm. And doing it well, honestly, doing it well and being recognized for doing a great job. Those are important aspects to me professionally, just because of me as a person, that's my personality.
Yep.
So I would say those are kind of the two areas to me, I define success.
Yep. Not to put a corny phrase to your beautiful statement, but go big or go home, right? Like, yeah, if you're not doing it all, then why even be there?
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think that also goes back to if you're questioning, am I in the right field? Am I doing the right? Am I in the right role? I think you can take a look back at, you know, what are you contributing? You know, and if you kind of look at your peers and maybe see, I'm not quite delivering to the same scale, that could be a sign.
Right. That's great. This has been great, AJ. Before we let you go, just want to ask, you know, where can people find you on social media?
So I use most of the social media channels. LinkedIn, obviously, you can find me on LinkedIn, AJ Dopwell. And then I'm also on Facebook and Instagram. I haven't quite gotten into the TikTok. I don't think I ever will.
Neither have we.
No.
I don't think I'm going to go there. But yeah, you can find me on Instagram, Facebook, and obviously I do a little bit with Twitter. Mm-hmm. That's more for viewing. I like to view. I follow local celebrities. I love my mm-hmm. my local morning news crew. Now that I'm home every day,
right,
I can kind of watch that. So I follow those guys. And then I'm really into food. So I follow a lot with food on Instagram.
How could you not be into food?
Especially with this year. I mean, you gotta have something.
Well, AJ, thank you so much. This has been great. You know, we loved having you on, and thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Absolutely, guys. And thank you so much for having me. I do appreciate, Jeff, you reaching out, mm-hmm. inviting me to engage in this opportunity. And congratulations on this podcast. I think it's going to be a huge success, like with everything else I know you've been involved with. So kudos to you and Sophia. congratulations on this role as well.
Thank you.
Well, that was a great conversation with AJ. I especially enjoyed his take on how pharma really is not that different than all other industries, despite what the outside world may think, and that the core principles of marketing still apply. And now it's time for Footnotes with Sophia.
Footnotes is where we expand on portions of the discussion that we wanted to learn more about and share with you. So one thing that AJ mentioned was that a few years ago, he read an article saying that pharma healthcare marketing industry was the second most regulated industry after finance. When I looked further into this, I couldn't find any research that linked the industries in rank order, but there's no denying that pharma and finance are two of the most regulated industries. More specifically, pharma regulation includes not only the process of regulating and monitoring the drugs themselves, but also the process of manufacturing, distribution, and the promotion of those drugs.
Yeah, it's funny when you say it, because I think we all are familiar with how buttoned up the industry is in terms of all the different cycles it takes to put different drugs out on the market and everything that has to go into all the clinical trials. But yeah, from a marketing perspective, they are very restricted with what they can and can't say. And the same to some extent is true in finance, but in pharma, how the entirety of the value chain is really heavily regulated.
Yeah, and I don't know how this plays into the finance industry, but specifically for pharma, only two countries actually allow pharma to direct to consumer advertise when it comes to their products.
Yeah, and actually it wasn't even legal in the United States until 1997. So it's still even relatively recent that the United States adopted it as well.
And the other country, in case you're wondering, is New Zealand. Another topic that we discussed in our conversation with AJ was research that we had done on our end, finding that one of the biggest problems going into 2021 is the need to connect and collaborate with our teams. If you are interested in learning more about this, feel free to see our Circan Stories episode where we discuss the story about this precise problem in full depth.
Thank you, Sophia. As always, all of the research and references can be found in the show notes. And if you want to reach out to us directly about this story or to inquire about sharing your own story, you can reach us at lsspodcast@circanresearch.com. Thank you for listening, and we hope you'll join us for a new story next week on Long Story Short. I want to thank Circan Research for being the sponsor of our show. Circan Research fuels demand for B2B marketers looking to gain a competitive advantage. We leverage original research and data-driven content to supercharge your growth. You can find out more on our website at circanresearch.com.